Okay, well, as a major league game gets started, when the umpire bellows play ball, and at the clubhouse, we always start the same way by where I say, to those of you who have not been here before, welcome. And to those of you who have been here before, welcome home. And to those listening to the podcast, we are live at the Bregino Baseball Clubhouse in the landmark cast iron building at 67 East 11th Street in Greenwich Village. The podcast only runs 1 hour, but I'm sure tonight there'll be many questions. So at some point I may just stop the podcast part of it, but we'll continue as long as Lee feels up to it. I have known Lee for over 20 years, Lee Loewenfisch, and dating back to my days as a sports agent. And Lee and I took quite an interesting trip to Binghamton to see one of my minor league clients at the time, who went on to the majors, as it turns out. But I decided to eventually leave that world and start making handmade gift baseballs. And that started in 2001. The store has been here since the summer. And this is our last book event of 2010. We've had about a dozen events since June, and they've all been terrific. And I can think of no better way to end our first calendar year of these events than with my old friend Lee Loewenfisch, the author of many terrific books. But tonight we're going to focus in on The Imperfect Diamond, published by Bison Books from the University of Nebraska Press. And usually Rich Ackerman, another good buddy of mine, does the interviewing. Unfortunately, he had to do his real job tonight. So I'm pinch hitting. And it's in some ways this is going to be very easy. Some ways it'll be difficult, because with somebody like Lee here, I feel that I could have Lee as a guest from now until next December, and we won't even touch on everything. So I think what I'm going to do is just kind of throw out a few little words or people or items from his book, and then I'm going to let Lee talk about those, and then we'll open it up to questions. So I guess to start, we may as well do this in somewhat of a chronological order. Baseball has this romantic, there's this romantic notion surrounding baseball that now the players are greedy, as we can see from the live coverage at the winter baseball meetings on the screen, $10 million contracts, $150 million contracts. But that romantic notion is not quite accurate. And it takes us to, let's start with 1885 and a man by the name of John Montgomery Ward.
Well, thank you for the nice introduction, and it's like we have our own winter meetings here tonight. it's so nice for people to come out on this cold night, and I've always felt that baseball as a sport, it can't ever be destroyed, because I think this winter, any winter, any cold weather makes us think of breezes and spring training and, you know, the rebirth of this great sport. What has always amazed me as a historian, though, is that the battles between labor and management in this sport go to the very early decades of its existence. And in 1885, John Montgomery Ward, who was not related to the Montgomery Ward department store people, but a fascinating person from Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, whose father died young, and at the age of 13, he went to Penn State prep school and got thrown out in a college prank and wound up a professional ball player in 1876, threw a perfect game in 1880, and then came to New York and threw his arm out. And so what did he do? He became a shortstop and a center fielder on the New York Giants. And some people think that the name the Giants was inspired by the play of John Montgomery Ward and his teammates. But in 1885, he became the first president of the professional, the Brotherhood of Professional Baseball Players. And what he was doing was he felt that the owners of that time were being increasingly unfair to the players. And he wanted the ball players who were professionals and had a rare skill that only a handful of people in the country had then or now. He wanted them to have a brotherhood to make sure that an injury to one was an injury to all. Now, what's so important is that it was called a brotherhood. It was not called a union. And fast forward 80 years later, when Marvin Miller becomes the first successful unionist in baseball history, he makes it a point that while his background was strict unionism, they are professionals and that they are above ordinary workers. And he played on that in the early years. And Ward pushed that too. But he didn't like the fact that ball players who were major leaguers but weren't very good were forced to collect tickets and sweep the fields after the game. And he wanted a contract that was fair to everyone, from the lowest to the top. Now, a few years earlier, in 1879, and I won't make this a history lesson entire, but I mean, I think it's so important in what I call the United States of amnesia that you know this history. In 1879, a reserve clause was put into a contract because there was a very colorful player named Jim Orator O'Rourke, who had been promised a uniform by his owner in Boston. And when he didn't get it, he moved to Providence. And the owner, who was one of the tightest of the owners, Arthur Soden, a plumbing manufacturer in Boston, said, "I can't have this. You cannot let this man leave. I don't care what I promised him." So they put in a reserve clause that said, "You're reserved until I tell you, basically, you can leave." And pretty soon, by 1883, there was a reserve clause being put in everyone's contract. Now, in 1885, the Brotherhood gets together. The reserve clause is not the biggest issue, but it's one of the issues. But it's still there. And what it meant, and it remained until nearly 100 years later, when Andy Messersmith and the retired Dave McNally got the arbitrator, Peter Seitz, to say you cannot reserve a guy forever. But for the next nearly 100 years, once you signed a contract as a baseball player, they reserved you year after year after year. And by 1889, the players were so upset at the sale of players. King Kelly, who was one of the doom players of his day, but one of the great players, was sold from Chicago to Boston for $10,000, which in those days, in the 1880s, was an enormous amount of money. And he didn't get any part of it. And a couple other players were sold, and they didn't want to leave their hometown, but they had no choice. And sometimes you even hear the lingering in other sports to this day, that if somebody walks out and holds out, well, you're going to play for us or you're going to get off the earth. And this was the rhetoric of the 1880s, which in American history was one of the more stormy periods. You have the Knights of Labor, which were a lot like the Brotherhood of baseball players, who said an injury to one is a night of all, is an injury to all. So you have the Sherman Antitrust Law will be passed in 1890, sponsored by the brother of John Sherman, who was the great Union general of the Civil War. So this is only a generation, 25 years after the Civil War, and now you have servitude in the baseball contract. So this was put out to the players, and in 1889, after the season, John Montgomery Ward led the players to their own league. It was called the Players League. There would not be owners. They would be called backers. Everyone would have a three-year no-cut contract, and the profits would be shared. And in 1890, they actually competed against the existing National League, and they actually outdrew the National League. But no one was making money, and the people, and this has been the history of America in any new sport, and maybe a lot of new enterprises and other businesses. When you start something as radical as the Players League was, which was cooperative, no reserve clause, long-term contracts. You can't do it in 1 year. You got to give it time. And the backers of the Players League got panicked. And Albert Spalding, who we all know as the great pitcher who didn't think of jumping from team to team when he was playing, but once he became an owner, said, no, you can't have that. Players can't be like that. Spalding is able to buy out the backers of the Players League, and they fail. And they only exist for 1 year. Now, there was also a blacklist put in at this time where if you didn't walk out on your professional contract in the existing leagues, anyone who played against you would be banished, and you yourself would be banished. And they couldn't blacklist all the players who left for the Players League because it was the star players, and included Charlie Comiskey, included Connie Mack, included Clark Griffiths. And I mentioned in the introduction to this latest edition of my book, one of the highlights was I gave this book to Earl Weaver, who I'm an Oriole fan then and still. And Earl Weaver was a rare manager during the 1970s who supported the players in their battles under Marvin Miller. And I gave a copy of this book, and the first edition had a picture of the basic baseball field and the infield that was sort of, you know, rifted, you know. And next day I asked Earl, did you get my book? And he says, Broken Diamond? And he had actually been reading the book, and this is a memory I'll never lose. He turns to Cal Ripken Sr., who had been his long-term coach, and he said, do you know that Connie Mack and Calvin Griffiths were in players' unions? And, you know, when I walked out of the dugout back into the stands, you know, my ex-wife looks at me and says, you look like you had died and gone to heaven. So that, until the 1960s, there was not a successful union. And the first half of this book deals with the attempts of people after John Montgomery Ward, who incidentally was the Joe DiMaggio of his day because he married the Marilyn Monroe of his day, named Helen Dovray, and that marriage didn't last very long. And somehow Ward was able to lead a players' league, be a very good ball player during that league, go through a very stormy life at home, and continue to practice law and speak in five languages. So he's a remarkable figure, Ward. And then he wound up becoming a lawyer and an amateur golfer, and not ever part of the establishment. He briefly came back as the president of the Boston Braves, but he didn't last long there. And he got into the ball players today are not what they used to be. And he died, you know, he lived a fairly full life, died in 1925, and opposed any antitrust action against baseball because he felt in his later life that baseball needed special legal protection because of the unique nature of the sport. And one last incident before we go on. When I first interviewed Marvin Miller for this book, I mentioned that John Montgomery Ward had wound up being a lawyer in for the league. And you ever think that could happen to you? And, you know, Miller and all his ponderous sat up, oh, I would never accept a bribe. So if you want to know why there was all that kinds of hostilities toward him, at both as a unionist and as a person, I got an early indication of that, you know, years ago.
I was planning to go chronologically, but I think it's appropriate that we jump ahead since you mentioned Marvin Miller. And before I ask the question, though, I just want to mention to those listening on the podcast, I assure you everyone is rapt attention to Lee's word in our standing room only crowd. If you're hearing any snoring, that's Sinatra, the little mascot of the clubhouse, the French bulldog. So it's not a human. But let's skip ahead to Marvin Miller. And if you feel comfortable answering this, fine. If not, we'll go back in time to where we were going to go. And What are your thoughts about the recent Hall of Fame vote?
Well, I find it that the Hall of Fame has clearly stacked the committees so that he wouldn't get elected. And there's a parlor game going on amongst some of my friends and people in baseball is that who voted against him this last time, because he only voted there was only one vote shy, and I would lay odds that Frank Robinson was the player that voted against him, because he did not support the 72 strike. And I don't want to get too technical here, because it's so important to understand why baseball went through this stormy period of strike, lockout, threat of strike, threat of lockout, because, you know, here's this outsider from the steel workers and a trade unionist to the core coming into a bunch of really Republican ball players, but who had some history of knowing that in the past, they had been, their right value had been limited by the reserve system. And so there was a great education going on there in the 1970s. But once Miller retired, and he was threatening to retire throughout the late 70s, once he retired, you know, for a brief period, Kenneth Moffitt was brought in to replace him. And Moffitt was the mediator in the first strike. And the fact that the ballplayers chose a mediator was assigned to the owners that the players were willing to accept half, you know, because a mediator's often, you know, just halves it. And the owners being the owners, with some rare exceptions, if they thought the mediator was going to be glad to take half, well, maybe he'll be glad to take a tenth, you know. And so it got to the point where there was a real bitterness between Moffitt and Miller, and Moffitt actually changed the locks on the door because, you know, Miller was coming back to write letters to the players, and ultimately he was fired, and Donald Fear came in, and, you know, Fear. Fear was new to the business, and I recount it in the next to last chapter in The Imperfect Diamond. He did not understand, as many outsiders wouldn't understand, how deep that passion was to control the players the way they had been controlled all those years. And when it comes to 1985, the new commissioner is Peter Ueberroth. And Ueberroth is fresh from being the king of the Olympics, and he decides that he's going to put in drug testing on his own, and he's very good at the start of baseball's boom. Really started with Ueberroth, because he was experienced in the travel business. He knew how to hire women because they were very successful for him in the travel business, and baseball's marketing skill started in that period, but he came in, tried to put in a drug testing provision without any cooperation or consultation with the players, and then worst of all, he orchestrated the collusion, and the collusion was a meeting which ultimately became in the record, and an arbitrator could rule on it. Indicated that if the players didn't bid on, if owners didn't bid on free agents, let them stew out there, and they, unfortunately from the owner's side, they put it in writing, and so that became the case that Fear brought to the arbitrators, and a big 2 years later, the arbitrator Nicolau and the other one put penalties of up to $300 million on the owners. And as a result of this, the owners, having to pay that amount of money to the players, decided we got to make up that money somewhere. And so they expanded. And if there's one thing that as baseball fans gathered here, now we might not all agree, but I think most of us would agree, if baseball only had 24 teams or maybe less, the level of the game would be so much better. But the reason we have all these extra teams was that they expanded and they got the big money entry fees from people in Colorado and Tampa and in southern Florida. And so that's so I can see how some of the old guard in baseball, when it came time to honor Miller, decided that all their problems began with him because he was an outsider. He wasn't one of them. And he took them, and with his successor, Donald Fehr, to the cleaners every time.
Right.
So I so it's he belongs there. But in the interim in this period, as collusion was going on, I was signed to write his memoirs. I thought I was writing the memoir of a retired man who would reflect in tranquility, but it was not the case. I mean, he was angry, and I mean, what he's saying now in response to his not getting in was sort of what he was saying, and I didn't feel that the readership really wanted to hear that amount of anger, and so it was an unfortunate situation. But in terms of the accomplishment that he made in the 60s and the 70s, there's no doubt that he belongs there. There is still the problem that there are too many teams, and there's always going to be an owner, a billionaire like this fellow in Washington, who will spend that money on Jason Worth that is out of control. But fortunately, the owners have learned that they're not going to stop, you know, one guy is not going to stop their business, you know. And as I put in the last edition of The Imperfect Diamond, you know, Selig, who was through all of this, first as the man who brought baseball back to Milwaukee after it had moved to Atlanta, Selig says, I'm not going to get upset about any one contract. And so similarly, you know, Worth is an unfortunate contract, in my opinion, because he's not really the superstar player. You know, the game goes on, and there's so much money to be divided that there's not going to be the work stoppage that threatens football and basketball, although in my opinion it won't come to that in either of those sports, in part because their unions are weaker. And there's, I mean, you know, in the world we have now, I mean, we need sports, you know. We need the escape. So I think I'm happy to say that baseball has finally developed a leadership that realizes you can argue about, you know, how much somebody is worth. As I begin this book with, you know, Messersmith McNally, Dick Moss, you know, Miller's right-hand man, says to Lee McPhail, representing the owners in that case, that Messersmith McNally, the first players who actually were willing to go to arbitration, that you cannot reserve me forever. And, you know, Dick Moss says to McPhail, are you afraid that the player is going to get what he's worth? And McPhail says, no, I'm afraid what he's going to get more than he's worth. And that's American capitalism. You know, now I tend toward an anarcho-syndicalism, as in Monty Python. You know? I'm not a serf, I'm an anarcho-syndicalist. But, you know, I'm a realist, too, and this is capitalism. So, and as I say, I'm very glad that, you know, baseball has finally reached, I mean, Lord, they've had 15 years of labor peace, you know, and it looks like they'll have another at least 15 years.
Well, speaking of baseball and capitalism, perhaps there was no better example than American form capitalism than the 1919 throwing of a World Series. So, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, your thoughts on Kennesaw?
Well, if I say so myself, what makes The Imperfect Diamond a good read is that the picture of Landis in this book is not as negative as you'll find in a lot of baseball books. I think it's in part Tony Lupien, the late Tony Lupien, who was my collaborator on the first book and who had a big battle with the owners when he didn't get his job back after the Veterans Act of World War II, said you were entitled to it. Lupien knew Landis a little bit, and Landis liked to call himself the Players' Commissioner. commissioner, and he knew the reserve system was not legal. And one of the things he was the proudest of is that he kept baseball out of the courts from 1920 until he died in 1944. Now, it clearly was very conservative to racist. There's no doubt about that, as were most of the owners. But on the labor issue, he kept them out of the courts, and he told many a player that if you think you've been maltreated, come to me. And he wound up freeing individual players on a case-by-case basis. Now, the most famous one to New York fans certainly was Tommy Henrich. Tommy Henrich, who I once met, and he passed away recently, and he was, you know, a really classy guy from the Yankee dynasty of the 30s through the early 50s, late 30s. Henrich had signed with the Cleveland Indians. He was from Massillon, Ohio, a real football hotbed. And he was trapped in the Cleveland system, and he signed for... And Cleveland was shipping him to different minor league systems without his knowledge and without the right paperwork. So he comes into Landis, and Landis says, well, this is wrong, and he had it for Cy Slapnicker. Isn't that a great baseball name, Cy Slapnicker? You know, you can't make this up. I mean, I'm in Sabre, and, you know, there's a guy named Ernie Infield in Sabre. So Cy
Slapnicker,
I never met him, and I think he's gone. You know, I think he was out in the pasture. But Cy Slapnicker, Landis was out to get. And so Tommy Henrich becomes a free agent, and he signs with the Yankees. And, you know, I've come in my older years, and it shows in this last two editions of Perfect Diamond, I understand where the owners are coming from. You know, the fact that Henrich signs with the Yankees at a peak when the Yankees were in the dynasty, you know, the other owners were saying, well, we can't have everyone being a free agent because they'll come to the Yankees. I mean, and he laughs. But I'm a tolerant guy. So look at Catfish Hunter. You know, flash forward to Catfish Hunter. He signs with the Yankees. So Landis, though, felt the Henrich case allowed him to have the free agent choice. Now, on the other hand, Bob Feller was signed by Slapnicker and was signed underage. But because Feller wanted to play for Cleveland really much, and he decided to let Feller. And Feller is the oldest living Hall of Famer, not in the greatest of shape, but, I mean, you know, anyone who's ever been around Bob Feller is, I mean, he really is an icon from that period when baseball was the national pastime. I mean, listen to Bob Feller with Costas talk about how his father never took a day off from work in his life, but after work he would always catch him and build that barn, target behind the barn, so Feller could be a great pitcher. And that Feller, you know, gave a lot of years to the Navy in World War II, and never looked back. You know, it was Bob Feller who once said that Marvin Miller was very good for the major leaguers, but not for baseball. And, you know, I understand where that's coming from without necessarily agreeing with it. So Landis had a different way of looking at players, really case by case. And I got into some email correspondence recently with Lincoln Landis, who is a nephew of Landis, who was kind of raised by Kennesaw Mountain. And I asked him what he thought if Landis had lived when Branch Rickey gave Jackie Robinson's contract to him. And he said, what a wonderful question, you know. And, I mean, my feeling, and I've written about that, is that he couldn't have done anything. He wouldn't have liked it, you know. But what's fascinating about, you know, my earlier work updated and this latest work is that, you know, on baseball issues, you know, Rickey was profound on labor issues, he was, you know, conservative to, you know, to right wing, you know. Landis on race issues was, you know, really, I hate to use the word conservative because, I mean, I like the term conservative when it isn't neo and when it isn't, you know, I mean, you know, going bombing around the world, I don't call it conservative, I call it radical, but I don't want to get into nomenclature. But Landis, on as a legalist, you know, understood that baseball contract was always going to get into trouble. And once he dies, you know, they bring in Happy Chandler for a while. And Chandler is sympathetic to the players, too. But the players, the owners, had lived under Landis for a quarter of a century, and they didn't want anybody to come in with the autocratic hand of Landis. So Chandler begins to get the owners upset because he supports the pension that comes in. And I think one of the most valuable parts in the book, if I say so myself, is dealing with 1946, because that's the years of the three crises, you know, that the owners are facing. I mean, you've got the Mexican League, which is a really major one, because Jackie Robinson and Phil Rizzuto are tempted by these millionaires, the Pasquales. Stan Musial is tempted, and once Pasquale fades away, or to make sure that Musial's not tempted, his salary is $13,000. The next thing you know, you flip it around, he's earning $31,000. So that's how underpaid they were back then. So that's crisis number one. Number two, there was a union formed in Pittsburgh by Robert Murphy, who was a Harvard-educated labor relations student. I mean, he never finished law school, and he's one of these shadowy figures, but he's really... I love the people in history who, you know, don't have the press agents or the big boosters, but he set the tone for that, you know, that Miller built on, you know, 20 years later. And the Pirates almost struck in the 46 game against the Dodgers. And they actually voted because they wanted the union recognized. And at the last minute, they changed the vote from majority to two-thirds, and they didn't strike, and Murphy by the next year had faded away. And then the other crisis at that period was the Gardella case that started. And, you know, I mean, Murphy and Gardella were way before their times, you know. Gardella, briefly, was the player who I got to interview, and it's a great memory. He lived in Yonkers, and this was about 1979, and he was the first hippie, he called himself. And this is 1946. And you know, hippies, this is the end of the war, and people are dying to go back to start normal life, raise families, get to the new suburbs. And Gardella is a real free spirit, and he plays for the wartime Giants. And, you know, one of the things he does, he was both the first hippie and also one of the first white lifters, and he had a roommate who wound up going to the Mexican League with him.
Reyes.
And
Reyes,
and he goes outside one of the hotel windows on the road, and he leaves a suicide note. And so Reyes is going out. You know, this is a prank, you know. and so when 46 what happens? The first post-war spring training. And he misses the flight to spring training, and then he comes in without a necktie, and they basically tell him, get out of here, you know. And so he meets the Pasquales at the Altoon. I have it in great detail, the health club. There are four Pasquale brothers, and he goes down to Veracruz, and he hits a home run in his first game. They have big crowds. But just like what I said before about the Players League, Mexican League has been in existence for a long time, but not with the kind of money that Pasquale had. But their conditions are not good. I mean, there was a railroad track through the outfield in one of the ball clubs. So the game had to be held up, you know. And, you know, I've always wondered, you know, I was the blackout in 77, Lenny Randle was at the home plate, you know, when the lights went out. I always wondered what would have happened if the ball were in the air. And what the ruling would have been on that, you know. Well, this is the railroad track would go through in 46 in Mexico. So Vern Stevens is another well-known, much more talented player than Gordell, and he goes and he comes back immediately. Well, so what do the owners do? In 46, they pass a rule that says anyone who's going to the Mexican League can't come back for 5 years. Now, I found out since the Ricky book came out, is that he felt that was too severe, but it was still in effect. And Gardella basically is blacklisted. He can't play semi-pro ball, and he can't play anywhere in minor leagues because he's on the blacklist. So the word comes to Fred Johnson, his lawyer, who is gone now, but was a great character I got to know pretty well. And Fred Johnson, who grew up in Cincinnati, his family knew Barney Dreyfus, so he used to go to games with the Pirate owner when they were in town. Fred Johnson finds out from his dentist about how Gordella can't play. In fact, there was a Negro League team that was warned, if you play against Gordella, you forget any chances of getting into integrated baseball. So Johnson meets Gordella, and they file this antitrust suit. And it's 20 years before Curt Flood, and a much better case than Curt Flood, because Gordella is this journeyman, you know. Flood was one of the highest paid players in baseball. And the case goes through the court system, and Johnson is a constitutional lawyer, had written an article on the U.S. baseball law, as it was called, in 1939, and basically accepts baseball law because of the peculiar nature of the game. But by 47, after he sees what's happened to Gordella, he takes the case, and it winds through the courts, and they win a big victory in the appellate court. Justice Jerome Fanks says, excusing servitude in the name of, you know, the peculiarity of the institution is an excuse for servitude. So the owners are getting really nervous, and so they buy out Gardella basically, and Happy Chandler's comment is, "I feel so happy that I feel like if I were a drinking man, I would celebrate," you know. So that case does not happen until Flood brings it, you know, 20 years later. But they're always they're playing with fire with this thing,
right,
for a long time, which I, you know, recount chapter by chapter.
Well, we used to I remember playing softball once in Harlem, and we complained about a dead chicken we found in left field. I had no idea about railroad tracks to an outfield, so it wasn't that bad. But you would have obviously been a great hitter because...
You obviously haven't seen me play. and I have witnesses that I hope they remain silent.
Well, you haven't seen me pitch, but you read my mind on everything I was going to throw at you, so we've knocked off the next about four checks that I had here. So I'm gonna now take this in a little bit of a different direction, if I could. I just want to check how we're doing with our podcast time. We're doing well. Because I think we touched on a lot of the book, and obviously we could go on and on with Lee Loewenfisch, the author of The Imperfect Diamond, which is obviously a fascinating book, and it's obvious you're tremendous storyteller, and your knowledge is outstanding and enlightens all of us. But what I'd like to do is, because you love the game so much, I just thought of this idea the other day. I haven't done this with any other authors, and I didn't tell you I'm going to do this before, so hopefully you won't get upset. But I was thinking about that show that I don't even know if it's still on Bravo, Inside the Actor's Studio, where the guy would ask these crazy questions of a questionnaire.
You're much more down to earth than Mr. Lipman. But Lipton.
Yeah, Mr. Lipton. Yeah, I don't dye my beard either. I won't ask the same questions, but in that spirit, we have a little sign here in the clubhouse, and that little story comes with each of the handmade gift baseballs that we sell. It's about somebody's first baseball game. Mm. So I would just like to ask you, what are your memories of your first baseball game?
Summer of 1948, Polo Grounds. Johnny Antonelli, bonus baby for the Boston Braves, pitching against the Giants. I remember there were a lot of hot dogs and soft drinks, and I think that was the first glimpse I ever had of the fellow who sold the soft drinks, who looked like an astronaut at the Polo Grounds, you know, with that a silver backpack and a little spigot on the side. And I'm not a collector, but I tell you, if anyone knows where I can, I'm sure it's on eBay. Somebody
right.
has it. The game that made me a permanent anti-Yankee fan was 1949. I was in the bleachers, and I looked this up. I mean, June 26th, the day before my 7th birthday, the Yankees are playing the Tigers in a doubleheader, and the Tigers lose the first game, and there's a guy sitting next to me on the other side from my father and says, "Kid, what are you rooting against the Yankees for? They're winners, you know? Be with a winner." Well, you know, I wasn't a rebellious kid, so, you know, I'm weighing it, but he's got a point, you know. So, we'll see what the second game does. Well, Pat Mullen hits 3 home runs in the second inning game for the Tigers. He had maybe under 90 for his career. The Tigers win the game something like 9-3, and I've never looked back. I've had my pain, but, you know, it's, you know, I've had my joy. Like, you know, A.A. Rod standing with his bat on his shoulder and that smirk that he used against Uehara after he struck out, and then they didn't call it, and then he hits a home run in the next pitch. Well, the lasting memory is that for this year is him just being called out on strikes. And, you know, and Joe Girardi's got to wear 28 again, you know.
Well, as a Mets fan, I completely understand that emotion. Who has been your, any time through your baseball life, your favorite ball player?
Well, you know, Eddie Murray meant a lot to me in Baltimore. I mean, I had already moved back to New York. But Eddie Murray, coming out of the rocketing through that Oriole farm system when Reggie Jackson went to New York as the free agent. Eddie, you know, coming up and the way they handled him, they used him as a DH, and then Lee May played first, and then they swapped next year, and May's one of his last years in Baltimore. In recent times, Murray was really, you know, it's kind of those, it might surprise Met fans who really got the Eddie Murray near the end of his career, who got surly, and, you know, Edward Bennett Williams, one of the many owners, villain number one for screwing up my team, and Angelos, of course, is number two. But, you know, I was with Edward Bennett Williams a week before he went public with his attack on him. I'm paying him $3 million, and, you know, and the fact is that Eddie had gone on the DL because he had never been on the DL. I mean, that's where Ripken learned to play every day from Eddie Murray. And he in his Hall of Fame speech, he stressed that over and over again. But they misdiagnosed his ailment, and he actually got hurt on one of the rehab machines, you know. So Murray, in the more contemporary part, and I guess it's a tip as how old I am, because, you know, I go back further to Robin Roberts, who I think is the late Robin Roberts, was such a special person. The man he and Bunning brought Marvin Miller into baseball, and Roberts was one of the first people I interviewed when I did this book, and I'll never forget him. He was coaching University of South Florida. I was waiting in the hall for a while because he was with somebody else, and then I said, "I'm doing a book on the labor history," and fire away. That was his first meeting. That's far cool. away. And he was Jim Palmer's first roommate in Baltimore.
Oh, wow.
And he only had one brief word of advice for Jim Palmer. Throw the hell out of the ball.
So, well, he listened.
Yeah.
Well, ball players come and go, and unfortunately, so do ballparks. So, your favorite ballpark?
Well, Memorial Stadium, I have very special memories for because they won, and they were the less is more team. You know, Reggie leaves, and they get Lowenstein and Renicki to split the position, and they get more production, and they're happier. The Polo Grounds was a strange place, but if you were sitting in the upper deck in right field, you know, you had some in the infield, you had some great views. Among the newer parks, you know, Pittsburgh is a great park, PNC, and amazing they've kept the same name. You know, I mean, I guess the bank's doing well. The new one in San Francisco is really special. For those of you who haven't seen it, and just see it on TV, the Coke bottle is actually a kid's park that you can walk in, and I think you can even walk into that glove that's way out in left center. So among the newer ones, those are, and of course Fenway and Wrigley are really, really special places too. In fact, in the audience tonight is one of my old softball buddies, Havelock Hughes, and one of the great stories about how baseball just develops our lives. Baltimore buddies and I went on a Midwestern tour, and we lucked into seats behind home plate for a Cardinal Cub game, which is a more sedate Yankee Red Sox, but not that sedate. And a few months later, Havelock says, "Were you at that game in late July in Chicago?" He had actually seen me behind home plate.
That's
on
great.
WGN. So
that's,
you know,
great. Well, we're going to get to Havelock and and our audience and open it up to questions. I just have one last question. If you could have been gifted with one baseball talent, what would it have been?
Well, you know, I did the Art of Pitching with Tom Seaver, you know, and that's 30 years ago now, almost 30. If I think I would have liked to have been a pitcher. Given my, you know, lack of prowess with the bat, I wouldn't have mind, you know, having some. I remember once in frustration, and I have to admit that I played with my nephew and his daughter over Thanksgiving Wii baseball, and I had as much trouble with that. But if I had the ability to, you know, hit the ball with power, you know, I remember I once blurted out, "I want power."
Well, you got power in your writing. So
no, that's very sweet of you.
And so now let's open it up to questions from our audience.
Can you comment on the instant replay that may be coming more involved in the current climate?
I'm not crazy about it. I mean, I think that what I would like to see, I mean, every ballpark have foul poles that are high enough that there's no doubt. I mean, I understand that some balls really you can't tell because some of these guys hit the ball so high. But I'm for better umpires. I'm for better trained umpires. I don't want it to turn into football, you know, where they're throwing flags and, you know, it's, you know, the disputed calls are part of the game of baseball. And I'm not for, I'll just repeat, you know, I want better umpires and, you know, the postseason umpires on merit, not on rotation. And I have a pet peeve, too. I want them to do away with six umpires in the postseason. I mean, we never would have heard of Jeffrey Meyer if there had been and I was at that game, if there had, Richie Garcia, who lost his job when Richie Phillips, the umpire's chief, had them put in their resignations, and one of them, the more, you know, martyred stories in the history of the baseball labor. And, you know, Phillips, Garcia was too close. And then the game against the Twins last year, I mean, Cuzzy, who's not a great umpire, just blew a call right in front of him. But they're not used to being in that position. So I'm for very limited replay.
Did you say that Robin Roberts and retiring Republican Senator Jim Bunning were the ones responsible or played a role in bringing Marvin Miller?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. It's a big chapter in the book. Roberts was a fascinating guy and a really down-to-earth but a competitor, you know. I mean, I respect Jeter on the field, you know, but the conceit of some of these people, Jeter being upset yesterday about people were saying I have an ego. Well, you don't get to the major leagues without an ego. I mean he might have been showing an ego that doesn't get him the kind of endorsements he wants, but that's another subject. So yeah, Roberts, Bunning, Friend, and Harvey Keene were on they interviewed Miller, and I spoke to Bob Friend recently. Because Friend and Dick Grote was also involved at the time. And they didn't want Miller because they were from Pittsburgh and they didn't trust what the steelworkers' attitude might do. But, you know, Friend told me something that I think is a very good statement. You know, when he met Miller, you know, what he remembers is that, you know, Miller said, "You may not like me and I may not like you, but this is what we're going to do." And they had failed so many times before that, you know, ultimately, he won the vote, and you know they got the riches that, finally the game seems to be on an even keel. Although, if I were speaking in San Diego or Kansas City or even Pittsburgh now, you know there'd be disagreement. But what are you going to do? You know, you could not. Have a guy for life, you know, and so what Miller did, you know, was a great achievement, and the players who stuck by him.
Actually, speaking of Republicans, wasn't there some kind of connection, or not a connection, but some type of overlap between Marvin Miller and Richard Nixon?
Well, yeah, I mean, to give you an idea of how Republican and how straight these guys were, I mean, Roberts, who didn't like the strikes that came later on. But Roberts, you know, respected Marvin, but he told him he wanted him to shave his mustache before he met the players. I mean, that's what we were dealing with, you know. That was another time, you know. But I mean, you know, I have I Xeroxed a photo from, you know, 1951, you know, Bob Swift and another Tiger moonlighting in the off season as police officers, and they're, you know, they're being, you know, for the camera, you know. I mean, you know, one of the reasons we love the Dodgers, the Brooklyn Dodgers, so much is they had off season jobs in Brooklyn, you know. Cal Abrams, you know, worked, and I got the Cal Abrams was one of my first interview on the radio on WBAI, and Abrams used to, you know, work at Abraham and Strauss, and you know, and you know, there, it was a very, very special time, you know.
I feel like the baseball season goes too late into the year. Do you think there's any chance of them ever maybe instituting more doubleheaders so that the season won't end in the middle of November?
To the first part, no. I mean, no one in baseball wants a doubleheader. Earl Weaver, you know, used to hate it because they were split, and you don't want to come to the ballpark, you know, in the likelihood of winning and losing. You know, I mean, it's like you don't want it in the same day. I agree with you. I mean, I think when they talk about expanding the playoffs without shortening the season, I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd. And the only way they're going to bring in another playoff that and not end in Thanksgiving is if they either bring in doubleheaders, which I would bet they're not, but also they're going to do away with that rule, which to me is a very sensible rule that no team can play more than 21 days in a row. I mean, you know, the thing is, the fans who are in the fantasy part of fans, they don't understand what it is to play this game every day, travel through time zones, and then, you know, deal with the pressures of the day, and then, you know, a day after day. I mean, you need, I'd like to see even less than 21 days. So, but, and Socha, who is probably, Mike Socha is one of the most respected people in baseball, whose assistants now are three managers, you know, Madden in Tampa, and Ron Renicki, Gary's brother, just got the job in Milwaukee, and Bud Black in San Diego. Socha talked about a 158-game schedule, and I mean, that's even too much for me. 154 lasted 60 years, but no one's talking about that. So, and they're talking about 18 games in schedule in the NFL, you know, which is really lunacy, but, you know, it's all, so, but it's a good question, and I agree with you, and it should be asked in many places, but as long as the Benjamins are coming into to the headquarters, I don't think you're going to see any shortening of the season.
We're going to continue with the questions, but to our podcast audience, unfortunately, we're going to have to say farewell. And once again, it's Lee Loewenfisch, author of The Imperfect Diamond, A History of Baseball's Labor Wars, from the published by the University of Nebraska Press and Bison Books. And it's been a true pleasure. And now we're going to continue with our questions at the clubhouse. Thank you very much.
Thank you.